And welcome everyone to another episode of All Things Trek. I'm Oren.
I am David.
And we are pre-recorded this week, and unfortunately Grace couldn't join us, but we do have introducing special guest once again, Kathy Ferguson.
Hello!
And Kathy, I believe you teach a class at the University of Hawaii called Political Theory in Star Trek. Is that the case?
That is in case the case.
Excellent. And you are also a professor of political theory and women's studies?
That's right.
Yes. So you have a long and detailed background with Star Trek, I have also been led to believe.
That's exactly right. It was pretty much the only TV show we watched in our house.
Well, that and Magic School Bus was a good one. And Captain Planet, which was a terrible choice. But Magic School Bus was good, and Star Trek. Those shows, they represent. So we don't have any emails this week, so I think we should immediately go to our main topic, which was your idea, Kathy. So why don't you explain it to the listeners?
Sure. Well, I've always been intrigued by the Star Trek episodes that gesture toward or suggest an alternative society that is in many ways very attractive, an alternative society where there's more justice, where there's less oppression, where people live better lives. And yet often it seems to me they don't really develop it. They kind of go there, they open a door, but they don't walk through the door. And so I'd like to think about what some of those possibilities were, those kind of lost possibilities for really exploring, really pushing people's imaginations to think about a way of living that is complex. It doesn't have to be simplistic, and has some depth to it, and offers alternatives that we could imagine pursuing in our real lives.
So things that maybe that would have been interesting if they'd had more time than a 42-minute episode, then.
Yeah, or done another episode.
Yeah, just have like another two-parter, right?
Yeah.
Well, and in some cases, I kind of think about the script turnaround rate, because I think sometimes they have an idea and it's interesting, but it could have just, if they spent more time on it and fleshed it out and thought more about the layers, you know, that could be involved with it, that it could be a better story, or like, you know, less plot holes, or just more well-rounded characters, or the society could have more to it. But then I think, you know, if it's from the staff writers, they got to crank them out. And, you know, there was the spec scripts, but my impression was they took some and used it, but not to a large degree. So it's not like they were just taking it every left and right, every spec script. So that's kind of another thing where it's like, oh, they almost got it, but they kind of missed the mark, or there was just not enough to it. But, you know, they can't write a novel, you know, they got to crank out the scripts.
Right. And some of the more interesting scripts have come from spec writers, early in TOS, Trouble with Tribbles. I know how much you love that one, David, full of tribbles. But, you know, yeah. That one is a spec script author, and that actually is kind of an interesting one where it really sort of goes into the concept of tribbles in general. But then, like, there are later episodes, especially in TNG. TNG had some really great, like, ideas that it didn't do justice to. Like, Kathy, you talked about opening a door and, like, not going through it. Sometimes it would open the door and we would find something we didn't like on the other side. And the one that comes to mind the most for me is The Outcast, specifically the episode with the Genai. And for anyone who doesn't remember, these are the race of people who supposedly don't have gender, but Riker falls in love with one of them who identifies as female. Because, of course, if you know, the only option, the only alternative to not having gender is to have male and female, right? Like, there couldn't be any other ways you could do that. They're a very repressive society. They, you know, if you identify as having gender, they put you in the brainwashing box and, you know, destroy your individuality. And it's no good. But then...
As much individuality as you could have when you all have to dress the same and have the same haircut and the same everything.
Right.
Right, including the same facial expressions all the time and the same body types. Yeah, that episode so frustrates me because when I first saw it, I loved it. And the reason I loved it is the reason I was supposed to love it. It was a progressive allegory about gay rights. And, you know, it was at the time, it was a really important thing for them to have done. And I I see it on that level and I appreciate it on that level, but it was so limited because of, as what Oren said, because it assumed that there are only two options. Either you have what we're used to, which is everybody's a man or a woman. And of course, that's not true here either, but people tend to pretend like it is. So you've either got a gender dyad or you've got some horrible oppressive society that puts people in the brainwashing box if they're differently gendered. And the idea that you could, that it could be something else, that you could imagine a society that didn't, wasn't based on a gender dyad, but was joyous, that was full of diversity, that people could, you know, that sexuality and erotic relations had many components to them and that people were free to explore. And they just don't go there. They set up a bad alternative to show us what's wrong with oppressing people because of their sexuality. And that's a great message, but it really abandons what's one of the great things that science fiction has to offer, which is to not just look at to look at the world in terms of two alternatives, but to kind of break out of that box and imagine different alternatives.
Right, and you talk about being stuck in a box. The episode is so stuck in its box of heteronormativity that when Riker is explaining human sexuality to, I don't remember her name, but the, you know,
Soren,
Dr. Soren. Oh, she's gonna blow up some stars? No, hang on, that's a different thing. but he's explaining to her human sexuality, and he can't be bothered to explain it in anything other than, you know, one man, one woman, monogamous relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, man, Riker, is that really all you know about human sexuality? It's a little more complicated than that. And obviously that was because they didn't want to, you know, alienate viewers was why they did that. But it really falls on its face. And because they don't even acknowledge that, you know, non-heterosexual monogamous humans exist, it's sort of hard to take that their analogy as anything other than, oh, look how terrible it would be if gay people were in charge, because they would all make you wear the same haircut, and it would be a race of lesbians, and they would oppress you, the one heterosexual woman. Which is, I don't think that was their intent. I'm pretty sure that they had good intentions in mind, but it just falls on its face because of that.
Well, and a quick little side note to that is one thing that I really appreciated, and I think it was in The Offspring with Data's daughter, Lal, that it came from Whoopi Goldberg and the Guinan character, and in the script she was supposed to say, well, when a man and a woman love each other, and Whoopi Goldberg was adamant to say she didn't want to say it that way. She wanted to say when two people love each other. Mm-hmm. And so I just appreciate it's a very subtle line change, and some people don't catch it, but it really speaks to a lot that, you know, it could be two women, two men, or, you know, especially in Star Trek, a gendered and a non-gender. It's just, you know, when people, and that was, I think, a limited scope of the writers. Times like that, and also, you know, in some of the other characters, I attribute it more to the writing of the episode.
Right.
Instead of, you know, really holding it as a flaw of Riker, which, you know, but in one case, we kind of have to think of it, well, that's how Riker presented it. Maybe somebody else would have said it differently.
Well, I mean, it's certainly not a fault with Jonathan Frakes, at least according to what
right.
he said after the fact. He was actually, like, his descriptions of what he wanted the episode to be actually sounded like a much better episode. Like, supposedly he said that he wanted Soren to be played by a man, which I think would have been fantastic. Because, you know, that would have just, for one thing, we would have acknowledged that homosexuality exists, and then we also could have shown that this is actually an alien society, right? And it would have been interesting
yeah.
and neat. But, yeah, it's reading some of their excuses for why they didn't put homosexual characters in Star Trek in TNG is kind of sad. Like, they were talking about how, Rick Berman has a couple of interviews where he says things like, well, we couldn't think of a good episode, like, of a good story to have gay characters in, and we didn't want them to just be side characters, so we didn't put any in. And it's like, really? That, what? that's
well,
kind of...
Well, and I think the best... Obviously, there could have been an episode focusing on it, you know, addressing the social issues about it. But in a way, I think another good way to handle it would just to be just have, you know, two guys kiss in the intent forward and not address it, because then it just seems like that's part of life. That's part of the day-to-day reality. And, you know, if you're not going to, you don't have to shine a spotlight on certain things to, you know, be inclusive and representing. But back to the Janai, another thing that I like with that Riker I mean, with Frake saying he wanted that character to be a male, I thought that was another thing about the Genii, that they're all played by women. And I thought, you know, that was another missed opportunity because, okay, let's say they're, you know, it's not, there's the negative side of it, but then also, okay, let's just go with their conformist type society. They all want to look alike and dress the same and everything. I thought it was a missed opportunity because then you could really address androgyny, where you have men and women dressed up the same, you know, the hair, the costuming, makeup, everything, to kind of show that there is, you know, in our real reality, there is the androgynous culture, the androgynous people, to where that could have been another thing where they're both, you know, men and women mixed together, and then addressing that there's just one, no gender to that. You know, it's kind of, it would be just another different take on it. But again, they just went with all women to, for that race.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I also really like your point about sometimes the most effective way to show something unconventional is not to make a big deal of it, but to right. make it ordinary. So two men kissing, two women holding hands, if that was just an ordinary part of walking into 10 forward, that would be a tremendously powerful statement. Right.
And I mean, that's what they did with Uhura in TOS, right? There's no episode about how, like, crazy it is that Uhura got to be on the Enterprise even though she's African-American, right? She's just there. And, like, they hardly ever comment on it. And so that's, you know, that's why those comments from, you know, Berman about early Star Trek just struck me as being very tragic and showed that he did not understand Star Trek at all. But on a more interesting note, I think, rather than hearing me complain about Rick Berman, which people can do any week, Kathy, I know you were talking about how interesting it would be to show a culture that doesn't have a gender divide as a way of highlighting some of the, like, the gender, like, stereotypes or discrimination that we have in our society that are based on these very often arbitrary distinctions between the genders.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, one way you can think about that is how there's more things to do with gender than just reverse it.
Right.
So when you're trying to imagine, you know, the sexuality and the genderedness or lack thereof of any society, Star Trek tends to get stuck in this move that in sort of the world of political theory is called a simple reversal, where you take what you've got and you just flip it over and say, look, that's different. And it is in some way different. I mean, it's different in if it's not too early to mention Angel One.
No, fine. Go ahead.
But, you know, they flip it over. They say, okay, patriarchy, that's when men are dominant and women are sort of sexual playthings and they are condescended to. Let's flip that over and have women be dominant and men will be sexual playthings who are condescended to. But, you know, that has some shock value at the very beginning. And it might have the possibility of drawing people's attention to, gee, well, you know, maybe that's not the best way to do things. But I also think it's really, really limited because it keeps the same terms, the idea that one sex has to be in charge and the other one is going to be condescended to and trivialized. And the question is, which one will it be? But the terms of the relationship haven't changed. Whereas they could have in The Outcast, and they did to some degree in Rejoined.
Yeah.
Not just flip it over, but shake up the frame a little bit. And so my complaint about The Outcast was that they just didn't go far enough. They reined themselves in.
Right. And
I think they do that in Rejoined too, and it keeps us from really. It doesn't feed our imaginations. It confirms the sort of the inevitability of what we've already got.
Yeah, and you mentioned Angel One before we go on to Rejoin, because there's a lot to talk about there too. But with Angel One in particular, you talk about a simple reversal. Angel One also, just because it's so silly, and you get the same thing with the Skreeans in Deep Space Nine, who are also supposed to be a matriarchal culture, and they're both portrayed as being like so ridiculous that it isn't like, well, look at this matriarchal culture and, you know, look at how weird it is. It's more like, man, thank God women aren't in charge. It's kind of the message you get from those episodes.
And in a way, it's very anti-feminist because it gives them the implication that you don't want to really mess with patriarchy or you'll get something even worse. that this is what feminists want. And I've always argued that the opposite of patriarchy is not matriarchy. The opposite of patriarchy is equality. Mm-hmm.
David, were you saying something?
Well, one last thought about the Janai and with the Angel One and those Skrii, that the men kind of became caricatures of, you know, instead of like fleshed out realistic characters. But the last thought I had about the Janai and the Outcast, or at least that episode, was about the whole brain box changing them at the end. I took that as a reference to how in our real world that there are those people who believe that homosexuality is a choice, and that if you get enough therapy or, you know, church or, you know, we could undo it and reverse it and that type of thing. So I kind of appreciated that they went to that, like there's those groups of people that think they could undo it. But I kind of thought it was another missed opportunity or a bad choice that in the episode they do that and it works. I thought it would have been a nice chance to say, like, that this culture said, we're going to do this to you. And, you know, if they're tinkering with your brain, obviously they could do a lot of different things to you about, you know, your behavior and stuff like that. But I thought at least in that one case that it, because her relationship with Riker, or just because the Starfleet was involved, that they tried to do that and it wouldn't work. And that would have been a nod to saying, like, yeah, that don't really work. You know, that's not a real thing.
Yeah, on the one hand, that would have been nice, because then they would have had to go back, right? I feel like the reason why they did that at the end was so that we could leave and, you know, have it all tied up in a bow and not have any reason for Riker to want to stick around.
Right.
And also, if they had done what Dave is suggesting, which would have made it a much more interesting and episode and a much more interesting planet, more interesting society, that society could have then portrayed the Janai society as itself a place of political struggle. If the authorities try to use the brain box to normalize everybody and make them similar, but it doesn't always work, then you could go on from there and say, and that there could be a resistance to it, and that Soren could have had an alternative other than either stay and be reprogrammed or flee, and that would have been to join the underground. There could have been some layers of politics that weren't, that doesn't you force you to imagine that there's only one thing going on in the society.
Right, because I mean there are underground and subcultures even in the most repressive environments, right? I mean there was still a gay subculture in Nazi Germany. Like,
right.
It existed. It was very heavily repressed, but it was still there. Like, you know, no matter how oppressive your regime, it's never going to drive out, you know, the people who don't agree with it entirely.
No, I agree with that.
So yeah, I think that would have been very interesting. Now, so let's talk about Rejoined, which on the one hand, Rejoined is a really good episode. It's the one where Dax runs into the current host of the symbiont that used to be in a past, you know, incarnation. It was the two of them were married, and then they have this, apparently there's this Trill taboo and also a law, it seems, against restarting old romantic relationships. And, you know, and the episode is also clearly a metaphor for gay rights and for not discriminating against homosexuality, but it's perhaps more interesting because they never really make a big deal about the fact that Dax and the other Trill are both women. Like, that's not really an issue. It never even comes up. But on the other hand, Kathy, as I hope you will tell us, it also raises a much more interesting possibility that is never explored.
Yeah, I think I agree with the first thing you said a lot. I want to praise the episode for the same reason you do. And that's that it does do what science fiction does best, which is Freud had this word, he called it the uncanny. And the uncanny is when you put what's very familiar up against what's very strange. And you use the familiar to shed light on the strange and the strange to open up the familiar. So that kind of juxtaposition of what you know and understand with what you don't know and can't comprehend readily. Mm-hmm. That's what science fiction is really good at. And so here's, you know, DS9, and they've got this forbidden relationship. And we as American viewers in the, what was it, 1990s?
Yeah.
We see two women kissing and we think, oh, that's forbidden. You know, we understand that it's a heteronormative society and that two women aren't supposed to do that. But In the story, as you say, it's got nothing to do with them being women. When people disapprove, it's not about the two women, that they're women, right? It's this whole other taboo that they're breaking. And so that juxtaposition of this familiar thing, which is the homosexual heterosexual matrix, and this unfamiliar thing, which is the idea that you can't reassociate with your past lives, that really opens that up. And I like that episode for that. So I give them full credit for that. But then it so frustrates me to once again, and the same thing that Dave said about the Janai, only, you know, in spades here, which is that they could have used that to really open up Trill society. I would have loved to have seen, and maybe as Dave says, there's limits on on what you can do in a script you have to crank out quickly and a short show. But my soul longs to see a story in which we actually explore the Trill homeworld, because it seems to me that if every episode we see about the Trill that I can remember, it's emphasized how valuable the symbiote is. That when you're a host, that the symbiotes, you expect that the symbiote's welfare would be first. If you have to die to save the symbiote, you do. You have responsibilities to the symbiote. It's a great honor to get a symbiote. And so the penalty for reassociation is horrible because it's exile from Trill, which means when you die, your symbiote dies because there's no doctor there to transfer it to a new host. And so exile is not just that you would live out your life somewhere else. It's that this highly valued symbiote would die. Okay, so if that's the parameters here, then it seems to me that, and then the second parameter is that you're not allowed reassociation. The taboo is that you can't pick up old loves. And I just rewatched all four of the ones that deal with this today. And at one point, it's stated that you are not supposed to reconnect with old loves, including your parents or your children.
Really?
From previous life. So not just your spouse or your partner,
wow,
but your parents or your children. And so that was, and then Dr. Bashir, this isn't a speech that Bashir gives to Kira when they're discussing what's all this taboo about. And Bashir indicates that Jadzia told him that there are some Trill that reassociate. And that is the door they could have gone right through. Because if there are some Trill that do it, then why not? And you can see why, so that you can continue to love your child, your parent, your spouse. Then why not imagine that those people would get together and create a social movement? And
or at least an underground where there may be some doctors who will do the transfer, but you know, it's not sanctioned by the government, it's not in official capacity. It's just like, you know, there would be that underground society or the subculture, and not just of the people that's like, let's just go over here and reassociate, but there may also be the doctors or the, you know, symbiont caretakers that would say, I agree, let's go, you know.
Yeah, and then, just that you should have the right to.
Totally, and that if there's, and that, so you could imagine it's like a Doctors Without Borders for the Trill, and the and so they, you could imagine that then you could really create, like, what would a social movement like that look like? And probably there'd be some that would go underground, the way Dave just said, maybe go to another planet, set up a colony, try to sort of disappear off the radar of the Trill homeworld, and have a different place to live. And once you've got surgeons and hospitals and so forth, you could continue Trill society elsewhere. But then you can imagine there might be a Trill underground, like they'd have the Black Panthers, and they would arm themselves and they would try to overthrow the establishment and create reassociation as a possibility for everybody. And then you could imagine there'd be kind of a Martin Luther King version where it would be more of a peaceful social movement where they would use civil disobedience, where they'd try to establish reassociation studies programs in universities, and they'd try to change laws. And so that would make so much sense as a political struggle that society is just inviting. And so it so frustrates me not to have that available for people to think about as a way that political change can happen.
I would love to see a series of episodes focusing on a on a Trill who went who did reassociate and was exiled, suing the Trill government and taking it up to the Federation Supreme Court. Because, like, we know Trill is a member of the Federation. Like, that is heavily implied in the show, and then it is made clear in, you know, in written sources, one of which put out by Larry Nemechek in Stellar Cartography. So we know Trill is a Federation world, and we also know the Federation has certain standards for how you are allowed to treat people, you know, if you're going to be let into the Federation. Like, that was, there's one episode, the one where Picard and Crusher are linked by mind implants, if I recall correctly, where they talk about how we're not sure if we can admit this one faction into the Federation because we don't know how they treat the other faction, right? And you have to meet certain humanitarian, although
right.
That sounds racist when you're talking about non-humans, but, you know, for lack of a better term, certain humanitarian criteria in order to be let into the Federation. And I would imagine that some clever Trill has probably figured out that banishing people for being in love with someone is probably not in line with Federation values or with the Federation Constitution, whatever that is.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think that...
Yeah. Another thing that this imaginary trajectory here of a Trill, a more worked-out Trill world would do would be really to invite or perhaps force the writers to be a little more clear on what this reassociation thing is anyway.
Right.
Because some things are clearly allowed. So Jadzia's friendship with Sisko is clearly, it's not just allowed, it's praised. You know, it's this model thing that we admire.
Well, even in the case of Jadzia and the other, I forget her name, her former spouse, they were even enabling them to work together on the same scientific research project. And of course, they're like, you know, looking sideways at them, trying to see, oh, are they going to reassociate? But at least, you know, if it didn't happen where they, you know, they wanted to rekindle and resume their relationship, if they were just two different people and said, okay, let's just abide by the law or rule and not associate, they would have been able to work together, even though they were, you know, symbionts, a host of symbionts that used to be in a romantic relationship, because, like you said, Jadzia and Sisko, they were friends, but they weren't romantic. Later on, we see Ezri and Worf, you know, reassociating. But even in those two characters, they were, okay, yeah, go do the scientific research together, but, you know, then they're just going to keep an eye on them.
Yeah, it seems, well, I mean, in that episode, we see that this restriction is incredibly arbitrary, right? Like, no one... It's supposedly it's about making sure the symbiont gets to experience new things and not just the same thing over and over again. But A, anyone who violates that, their symbiont will die. So it's like, wait, hang on a minute. How much do you actually care about the symbiont? And then we see with Ezri, no one blinks that Ezri is just going to continue living Jadzia's life after she dies. Like, that never comes up as an issue. And so that, you know, there's all kinds of questions there, and it makes you wonder, well, like, how technical can we get on this taboo, right? Like, you know, are we allowed to be, well, we can't be in a romantic relationship, but what if we're just friends with benefits? You know, we're not in love, but we have sex sometimes. Is that okay? Social taboo police? You know, this sounds like I'm joking, but honestly, I do want to have a better understanding of how this taboo works, and how does it refer to Trill law, and that's something that we never got to find out, unfortunately.
Well,
go ahead, Dave.
Well, just real quick, the thing that just popped into my mind, and obviously this was written way before and they didn't even look the same, but in that TNG episode where
right.
Crusher has a relationship with the Trill guy, and then at the end, you know, Riker has to take over, and that was kind of weird and creepy, but then they get another host that's a woman, and Crusher's like, I can't handle this, humans aren't up to that, and like, no, it's not humans, it's you, Crusher. That's a whole other side note. But in that case, Crusher wasn't a Trill with a symbiont, but that other person was, and so she was going to continue, that person and host and symbiont was going to try to reassociate and continue that relationship with Crusher. So that was like another case of like, well, what's the deal with that? Is it fine if the other person's not a Trill?
It's fine if
you thought of that.
If you're the Trill kind of thing that has like funny stuff on your forehead instead of spots, then it's okay. The funny stuff on your forehead makes it okay, is what I'm thinking here. But yeah, there's clearly a disconnect in your in the continuity between those two episodes.
You know, we rewatched Facets today, where Dax has her Jantara, which is all the hosts go into the bodies of her friends and she meets them. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking about how that also really complicates this whole business about the relationship among the hosts, because the big dramatic tension at the end was that Curzon had loved Jadzia when he was her teacher in the whatever, the academy or whatever they called it, the symbiosis training ground, and that he had suppressed, he had not let her know that, and in fact had been really hard on her and kicked her out out of shame for his, you know, inappropriate desire toward her. But then he felt so guilty that he let her back in, or he didn't object to her being readmitted because, as he says, it got him off the hook. Well, that's not unbelievable that people could have that relationship. But when Jadzia inherited the symbiote, why wouldn't she know all that? I mean, she's got his memories. So why didn't she also have the memory that he had loved her, that he had tried to repress his love, that he had tried to kick or helped dismiss her and then allowed her back in? Seems like there's a plot problem there.
Well, they have established to a certain extent that the symbiont, if we're getting into continuity issues here, that the symbiont can suppress memories. Like, that is something it can do. That, the symbiont suppressed the memories of an entire host. Duran, I think, is his name.
But wasn't that done by the Symbiosis Commission? I mean, the doctors did that, didn't they? I didn't think the symbiont on its own did it. I thought the commission doctors did that sort of independently of the symbiont.
Yes, but just what I meant is that it isn't too much of a stretch that the symbiont, probably still feeling the way Curzon did, because the Curzon is part of the symbiont now, still feeling that way would hide those memories. Seems to be the idea.
Yeah. No, maybe. I don't like to get too stuck in continuity because I want to give the writers a little slack here. You know, they have to do a job week to week, and sometimes it's too confining to keep everything straight. But it would be great if they would look at the various things that happened with the Trill symbiont host relationship and tried to gather it up into a complex ball where it didn't all have to be the same. It didn't even all have to be consistent. You could have different manifestations of this relationship, but that it had, like, that we paid some attention to what the implications were.
Yeah, that would be good. And, you're a kinder Trek fan than I am. I'm all on these weird continuity violations and, not making sense, stuff like that. And I wish that they had acknowledged that that's one of the things about the Ezri character that really bothered me, was that when Ezri showed up, she was doing all this reassociation and, like, it didn't ever come up as a problem, which to me kind of, like, retroactively made the rejoined episode not as interesting.
Yeah, well, I interpreted that she had never been through, symbiosis boot camp, right? Whatever kind of training you're supposed to get to be joined. She just got plucked off a, ship somewhere because she had a Trill body and they stuck a host in or a symbiont in her and it worked. I was more willing to go with that as a, that was a kind of happy coincidence. And because she was young and untrained, that's where a lot of what was, to me, interesting about her personality. Like, she wake up in the morning and she doesn't know if she's a man or a woman until she throws back the sheets. She wasn't ready. So that, I just want, to me, when you have this really interesting species, like one of the things that the Trill does for us today as contemporary humans on Earth is it really pushes us to think that gender is not foundational to our identity. That gender is very mobile, because, like Dave just said, in the TNG episode, it was a symbiont in a Trill man, and then it was a symbiont in Will Riker, and then it was a symbiont in a Trill woman. And the idea that it's I mean, the idea that you're either the same or you're different, that gets broken down. Sameness and difference are kind of together. They're more complicated. It's not either or. And so I think that's a great thing for humans today to kind of chew on, that gender and sexuality are not immovable foundations of identity, that they're kind of mobile.
Right.
And to some extent, they're created. They're not just discovered. So when you've got that great character that has all this diversity in her character, like, I just love the parts in Rejoined where they can't figure out what pronoun to use because Jadzia and Lenora are talking about their past hosts, which was Jadzia, the symbiont in Dax was Tarius, and the symbiont in Lenora was something, Nalani, I think. And it was me, you, I, we, them, her, him. They, you know, pronouns are hard to use if gender floats.
You know, would think the Trill would have more flexible pronouns than English. You would think that. I mean, English is there are languages on Earth that have gender neutral pronouns that are not considered insulting. You know, English just doesn't. You would figure the Trill would have some of those.
Yeah, and that was one of the things I liked about the Klingon language, is that their pronouns are gender neutral.
Oh, interesting.
The Klingons are more progressive than we are. We're in trouble. And I mean, I should point out, because I mentioned a couple of times how arbitrary the taboo is. That doesn't actually, I don't think that's a bad thing necessarily. I think if you look at it today, a lot of these, you know, these social restrictions, a lot of them are incredibly arbitrary, you know. Like, the reasons, if you actually examine, like, you know, opponents of marriage equality for, like, 5 minutes and try to parse down their arguments that are anything more complicated than because God told me to, that the arguments immediately fall apart. You know, they're always like, well, it's about tradition, traditional marriage. And it's like, do you know what traditional marriage was, bro? Have you looked at history at all? You know, things like that. So, like, very often these discriminatory policy or taboos are completely arbitrary and make no sense at all. So that wasn't a problem to me. I just wanted to see the characters, you know, explore it more and really go after it.
And it also kind of brings us back to where we were, this idea of lost opportunities, because it's precisely when social taboos are, as they often are, maybe even usually are, arbitrary and capricious and destructive, that people resist them.
Mm-hmm.
And so then we're back to, where are all the people resisting the Trill taboo? Why can't we see them and what they do and think of their challenge to Trill authority?
Especially in the relatively open and free Federation. Because, I mean, you know, nowadays, you know, if you have someone in a lot of places, you know, here on Earth, both in this country and outside of it, if you try to stand up against these social pressures, you can be in a lot of trouble. Sometimes you can even be in danger. But in the Federation, it would be very easy to either, like, to escape Trill if you had to, and you could go to a Federation planet that wouldn't, like, turn you away, and you could, you know, and you'd be safe there. So there has to be some kind of political movement against that, and I, you know, maybe they just succeeded off screen. Maybe that's why no one questions Ezri on her reassociation with Worf, because, you know, they've already won, right? It just happened so quickly they didn't show us.
Oh, I want the story.
I want it too. I'm just throwing out possibilities. So another one for me, because I, you know, we've been talking about this Trill a fair bit, but one for me that I thought was a huge missed opportunity to really explore, you know, an interesting culture was the Ferengi society, actually, because if anyone who has seen the end of Deep Space Nine will hopefully remember this, the story of Ishka, who's Quark's mother, is very interesting when it first starts off, right? And we have the first story that she's in where she's made profit, and that's against the law, and she's all about being like, no, I can make profit too. You know, I can also engage in free market capitalism. You guys can't tell me I can't.
And the thing I liked about that was that it showed that she was actually good at it. Like, mm-hmm. you know, the idea, it's like, oh, women stay out of finance, you know, it's a men's game or whatever. But then here comes her not just saying, like, you know, I want to do it too, and equality and access, but, like, showing that she could do it better than some of the other Ferengi men.
Totally.
And I just like that aspect.
Right, and then, like, unfortunately, the story gets bogged down a little bit because we have some other episodes that are not very good, like the Prophet and Lace, which is widely considered to be the worst episode of Deep Space Nine. But then what bothered me really was at the end when they wrap up the Ferengi storyline in the last few episodes of Deep Space Nine, they reveal that basically Ishka was actually, we thought Ishka was championing for equality in the free market economy, but actually Ishka was championing a socialist reform movement this whole time, and she's like talking about government funded social programs and passing taxes. And to be clear, I am a super socialist, so I'm not against socialism, but it did not fit with her character like at all, and it was really sudden and out of nowhere. And I thought it would have been more interesting to explore like what Ferenginar would be like once women were allowed to participate in this free market economy that they're all super excited about, right? Because they all love profit above all else.
And it's also a lot more, the possibilities of imposing something radically different from the top down, mm-hmm. like that, like we're going to go from, sort of rampant free market capitalism just that totally ravages everybody who's not the winner. We're going to go we're going to go directly to a welfare state socialist model because somebody at the top said to that, like, what happened to all the people in the society and what they thought? That's not how political change happens. It's not because somebody at the top orders an about face and everybody just turns and marches the other way. It has to come from the bottom. And so it would have been much more interesting, as you said, to imagine, let's say that Ishka won and women were allowed to be in the market. And then, as Dave said, a lot of them are going to be good at it. And so then that means domestic relationships are going to change. Women will wear clothes and things will happen. In Ferengi, there will be a change that comes because it emerges out of the change in the way people live. As opposed to somebody sending out a memo that, Okay, it's time for socialism, children, let's all move.
Yeah, and I mean, it felt like they wanted to wrap up the Ferengi storyline with, like, a neat little bow, and, like, then, but, and they didn't have enough episodes to do it correctly, so they were just like, okay, we'll put Rom in charge, and now Ferenginar is socialist utopia. Hooray. And I was like, that just doesn't... What? Come on, guys. I mean, I appreciate Quark's speech about how his bar is going to be the last bastion of Ferengi liberty. That is funny, but the actual story I did not think was very good.
Yep, I agree.
And, Kath, so I know you are very interested in the emotional Vulcans that we see in the episode Fusion.
Yeah. Yeah.
Tell us about those, would you?
Well, I like that episode... For again, it opened a door, but then it really slammed it shut. I just rewatched it today, and I realized that there were really two characters who were used to indicate the possibilities of this imagining Vulcan society in which, instead of repressing emotion, that Vulcans sought a balance. And so one of them was the guy that was the most memorable because he essentially mind rapes what's her name?
D'Pol. Yeah.
And so that storyline, if that's the dominant storyline, then that's a pretty grim message. That's the one that just slams the door shut, because the suggestion is, if you got any Vulcans out there who are trying to balance reason and emotion, they're going to be rapists. It's going to be, they're going to be so, like, he was so selfish. It was really a very compelling and disturbing scene, where up until then, he's been a somewhat interesting and even attractive character, and he has invited D'Pol rather than forced her. But then he gets to the point where she says no, and he won't stop. And so he does violate her, even though she fights him off. And so that storyline, it really suggests that D'Pol is right when she says Vulcans can't have emotion. They have to keep it constantly under wraps. Although, of course, they do. I mean, that's always overstated.
Right.
But But the other guy, what if they'd done, what if the rapist had been the subordinate character and the guy in engineering was the more dominant character, the one that we remember more? Because he's the guy who became friends with Trip, mm-hmm. and he was funny. He had all these funny misconceptions of Earthlings. He says something funny like, I hear that we've learned that you guys mate year-round with any woman you choose, eat six meals a day, spend more than half your day in bed. And Trip looks up and says, you haven't really hung out among Earthlings much, have you?
Is that not how you guys spend your day? I mean, I only just got out of bed.
And so he and Trip have a successful friendship. They have a very poignant relationship around the Vulcan's father, because his father is dying, and the father has disowned the son because the son has gone off in this radical direction of trying to be a Vulcan who combines reason and emotion. And the son, they had a rift for like over a decade, but then the son, under Trip's influence about sort of how regret is such a tragic emotion and that it's a good one to try to avoid, and so don't act in a way you're going to regret profoundly later. And the guy listens, and he learns. And in the end, he does contact his father, and he thanks Trip for what he's learned. And so it's a very mutual, so they both get a lot out of the relationship. It's not at all predatory. So if that had been the main thing, and then the other one had been the subordinate thing, I would have thought that one would have been a much better episode. It would have been less sensational, but would have led us, in terms of this theme tonight of doors that they open and then they don't walk through, I would love to see more thought given to the relation between reason and emotion through Star Trek, because they really aren't opposites. And there's just no such thing as somebody who has all one and none of the other. And we too easily let Vulcans stand for this pretense that they're opposite, and they're not. Feelings are a kind of knowing.
Yeah, I think that just a more, I guess, nuanced look at Vulcans was not really something Enterprise had on its mind, right? Most of the time when Vulcans show up in Enterprise, they're just kind of jerks for no reason. I guess that was to the point where they were acting so out of character that when Manny Koto took over in season 4, he felt like he needed to have a 3-episode arc explaining why these Vulcans were not acting like the Vulcans that we knew, why they were acting so rude. But even then, like, we never saw those Vulcans who tried to experience emotion again. Like, they just never showed up.
Right.
Well, but we did see Cybok, which was...
well, that turned out.
Well, and that was a thing that I looked forward to in Enterprise, is to see the progression of individual characters and the tone overall, but especially with the Vulcans, to see, like, if it did go to 7 seasons, like, how the Vulcans would have, you know, possibly changed or, you know, been affected by the whole scenario. But, man, just too bad it ended before it got its 7 seasons. But I kind of only vaguely remember that episode, so I'm going to have to go back and watch it.
Yeah, Fusion, it's not super memorable, honestly. Like, I mean, the reason that you'll remember it is for the scene where T'Pol is assaulted. Like, that scene itself is pretty hard to forget, but the rest of it is just kind of like, we met some weird Vulcans today. Moving on. Nobody talks about those Vulcans anymore. Which is too bad, because they had a lot of... I felt like Enterprise had the opportunity to try to acknowledge a lot of, like, the kind of weird stuff we'd established about Vulcan culture previous to the series. Like, you know, Vulcans are supposed to be, like, super logical and all about reason, and yet they still have, like, childhood arranged marriages, which don't seem very logical. You know, that doesn't seem to make very much sense, but that was not something that Enterprise decided it was going to tackle. They were just kind of like, no, we'll sidestep that issue. Just, you know, whoosh, let it sail on by. Which I thought was too bad.
Yeah.
And sort of along a slightly similar vein, actually, is another, like, door that I really wanted explored more, but they were not interested in this one, was the Klingon-Romulan colony in the episode Birthright, which is it's an okay episode. It's a two-parter. Worf hears rumors that his father might be alive. It it turns out that they're not true. His father is not alive, but there are Klingon prisoners of war that had been captured by the Romulans and had been kept as prisoners of war for such a long time that they had basically decided to stay with the Romulans instead of going back to Kronos because they wouldn't be welcome there. And so what you have is a case.
But then aside from just saying, well, we'll just stay here as prisoners, the key thing that was part of this episode is that both sides, the Romulan, you know, jailers or overseers, and the Klingon prisoners, eventually those characteristics or those lines blurred and dropped, and then they just started to become, you know, they intermarry, they started to, you know, live together, not just like, okay, we're going to maintain that we're just going to be, you know, prisoners and overseers or right. jailers, but, you know, actually kind of be at peace and in a way that they're going to create a new culture almost, and then, you know, intermarry, and that was an interesting episode.
And, like, to me, that episode was a little bit, it fell short because Worf basically shows up here and tells the Klingons that by living in peace with Romulans, they're living a lie. And then the Klingons kind of decide that he's right. And I mean, they pitch it in the context of you need to, like, be proud of your heritage. But it's clear for Worf that part of Klingon heritage is hating Romulans. And, like, you know, this goes all the way back to the episode where he wanted to let a Romulan die rather than giving him a blood transplant. And I was hoping that this would be an episode where Worf would get to see that he was wrong. But he doesn't really. They just kind of, at the end, it's not clear that Worf has learned anything. He just kind of goes back to the Enterprise and is like, well, I got those Klingons out of that mess. You know,
in the case of Worf, I mean, on one hand, there's definitely going to be just the ingrained, indoctrinated, you know, racism, basically, between Klingons and Romulans. But in the case, for some, not all of them, but in the case of Worf, you know, he's got the feeling and thought that his parents were, or at least his, you know, his parents were betrayed and killed by Romulans. So that's going to taint however he sees things going forward. But the other thing about this was, and not just that, like, oh, we're Klingons and Romulans and, you know, we're not supposed to live together because we hate each other and all that. It was that the fact that they were lying to the younger people, telling them that the war was still going on and that this was the only safe place, you know, where they could coexist because, you know, the war is still going on outside there, out in the world. And so part of it is Worf, you know, and the elder Klingons staying there, like, yeah, we shouldn't lie to them. You know, they should be able to make their own way and their path and, you know. So, but I don't know, there's so much to this episode that I think, like you said, is a missed opportunity. And then the other thing is that the main character that Worf, you know, gets involved with is Ba'el. She's half Klingon, half Romulan, and so there's like a whole issues with that, and that character is even carried on into the novels and, you know, still dealing with the fact that, you know, you can't really be at home on either side. So, but again, that could have been a way that, you know, and it was this camp at Kariah. So it's like they call it Camp Kariah. Like, it basically was the prison. And so I kind of thought it would have been a good opportunity to say, okay, let's kind of shut down this prison colony. Let the young people, you know, go and do whatever they're going to do. But then have this be an opportunity where, like, either on the same planet or on a different moon or planet, kind of create a pocket where they could have a little section where Romulans and Klingons could just coexist and not have to worry about the cultures of their, you know, homeworlds, about, you know, living the same laws and cultures and mores and everything, and just make your own little world, your own, you know, culture and society.
Right.
But they just like, nope, we got to just undo it and send everybody back to where they came from, basically.
Yeah. What you said about, the woman, the mixed race or mixed species person, and the sort of the lesson of not having a place is really ironic when you think that Worf then marries Jadzia, and they try to have a child, who of course would have been a mixed race child. One of the things I love about DS9 is that it's a place where all kinds of mixed beings can find a home. You know, Dukat's daughter, who's, you know, half Cardassian, half Bajoran, she finds a home. And Worf himself, you know, Klingon raised by humans, he finds a home. And there's a bunch more. Well, Odo, the shapeshifter, you know, kind of raised in a sense by humans. He finds a home.
Nog to Ferengi who don't fit into Ferengi society.
Right. And so all the, I think that's what makes DS9 such a great setting, is that it really encourages, again, back to what can science fiction do? It can give us a way to imagine a better world within a context that's very different than what we're used to. And so this idea that identity itself is a very mixed up thing, that it's not one thing. It's not an anchor around our necks. It's a kind of provisional thing. It can change. It has a lot of different elements to it. That character, the infusion, she needed a place like DS9 to have a home. And Worf, you know, it didn't seem like he was, I mean, it seems pretty ironic that in that episode he was having none of that, but by the time of DS9, he's one of the people both benefiting from it and furthering it.
Right. Well, and even, but then again, it's a different little scenario, because Worf, early on, we saw that he was with Kalar, who was half human, half Klingon. Right. And so, in a way, it's not just that, and then we see Baylana and other, even Spock. It's not just that it's a person of different races, of different species, of planets, but it's kind of like a similar situation with Zial, where it's like she's Bajoran and Cardassian, two races or two culture species that were the enemies at odds, and there's going to always be the animosity after that. And in the case of Bael, it wasn't just, oh, you're Klingon and something else, but you're of those two, you know, worlds that were always at war, always not going to be having a peace from the, you know, Romulan and Klingon, you know, that combination, because there was the Romulan element, he just couldn't get past it. But if she was, you know, Klingon and Bajoran, Klingon and Vulcan, Klingon and whatever, he would have been more fine with it.
Yeah, and I think it's not, like, obviously the Romulans are doing some unethical stuff in that episode, right? Like, it's, you know, they are, like, as David pointed out, they are lying to the young people and keeping them there. And
well, but hold on, just a side note to that.
Yes?
It wasn't just the Romulans, because those Klingons were complicit in that lie as well.
Yes, that's true.
So, you know, yeah.
So, it's certainly not that Worf wasn't at all justified in trying to tell these young people the truth, but it just... It sits the wrong way with me that at no point in the episode does it seem to acknowledge that there's any value in this colony. Like, you know, the older people decide to stay behind, and maybe I have to watch it again. Maybe I'm getting the wrong message from it, but to me the message seemed to be that, like, the older people are staying behind because they don't have a choice, right? And it's kind of like, well, they'll stay behind, but they'll let the younger people go off and, like, you know, go hate each other like proper Klingons, and, like, I don't know, that just, that felt like a very depressing message to me that I think they could have, you know, maybe done better to explore.
Yeah. Like, it could have been, that message could have been, let's go out into the world with this example of Klingons and Romulans living together. And instead of pumping up the young Klingons, and I agree with Dave, it was a generation thing, right? More than a species thing, the older ones versus the younger ones. Why not, instead of pumping up the young Klingons with, let's be good Klingons and hate Romulans, let's pump them up with, look what we've done. We have used our strength to overcome an old problem, and we're better for it. And so that could be the example that we set to the world.
Especially since, you know, teaching them Klingon heritage, there's nothing in Klingon heritage that says you have to hate Romulans, right? Like, that's a pretty recent occurrence, right? It's not like the old songs of Kales talk about, and then those Romulans were jerks. I don't think...
Right, Yeah, you're right. There wasn't... If anything, it would be that case about the Herc, but not about the Romulans. But the other thing about another missed opportunity... I love that episode, and, I mean, it doesn't really, in that way, relate to this topic, but the other half of that episode is Data... learning he can dream. So just that whole two-part episode, I love it. But in this case with the Klingons, another missed opportunity is we basically see, you know, Ba'el, she represents the Klingon-Romulan hybrid. Then we see Tok and a couple of Klingons where you could see that they're Klingon. They're not a Romulan mix. But we didn't really see a full Romulan youth, and that could have been another element to add into this, that, you know, aside from, you know, the Klingons who didn't get their history and culture told to them, and then now you have the hybrids that are having to deal with, like, you know, stuck between two worlds. That could have been the Romulan youth that were saying, you know, we want to go live, like we said, you know, have a place where we could just go live together, because maybe there would have been the full Klingon and the full Romulan, but they just grew up together and they don't have any animosity about some past wars or anything. So that they would, even though they could leave, they would still want to be together. You know, they don't want to separate from their childhood friend or their, you know, a Klingon that, you know, was with the Romulan. So that was just another level that, you know, we really only got to see Klingons and the Klingon-Romulan hybrid. We didn't really get to see the story or the aspect or perspective of the young Romulans who would want to, you know, leave that place but still continue on with the idea and the life of Klingons and Romulans living together. That was just another missed opportunity.
That's a good point.
Well said, David. So that's the end of my list. Kathy, did you have anything else you wanted to hit on for this topic?
No, I think I've covered mine.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us once again on the podcast, Kathy. It is always great to have you.
It's a pleasure.
And for anyone who ever visits our website, Datalogan sent us this very complete viewing order, like Excel spreadsheet of like the various Star Trek media out there, both episodes and books and comics, and like what order they fall in the timeline. So, you know, and I'm pretty sure that proves that he's a machine, because I don't think like a normal person could have put that together. But in any case, you should take a look at it, because it's really cool. And Kathy, we hope to have you again on the podcast soon. I hope you guys will, if you have any emails to send us, you can do so at allthingstrek@hotmail.com. And next week, we will be joined once again by Jera Hodge, because I need to keep up a certain feminist quota on this show, or, you know, or I just don't feel good in the morning. So until next week, this will be All Things Trek, signing off.